This episode offers psychosocial education designed to inspire and motivate our listeners. The information provided does not constitute a therapeutic relationship nor a substitute for professional mental health care. If you are experiencing a mental health crisis, call 911, go to your nearest emergency room, or for listeners in the United States, text 988 for the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Warning, this episode contains brain food that will lead to improved emotional and social intelligence. Thanks for tuning in to Harvesting Happiness today for a healthy serving of consciously prepared brain food. This is Lisa Cypress-Kamen, your host. Since 2010, we've been broadcasting sound ideas for better well-being. Each week, we spotlight diverse thinkers and doers who are contemporary trendsetters and change agents, devoting their lives to creating a better world. I invite you to listen and change how you think about human happiness. Our award-winning content is fresh, optimistic, and purpose-driven media that promotes well-being from the inside out. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. Thanks for joining me on today's show, where you will learn about medicine of mind for caregivers, advocating mental health and wellness with my guest, Dr. Jesse Gold, who is the Chief Wellness Officer of the University of Tennessee System and an Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. She is a fierce mental health advocate and a highly sought-after expert. Dr. Gold has written widely for the popular press. In her clinical practice, she sees healthcare workers, trainees, and young adults in college. She's also the author of How Do You Feel? One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine. Oh my gosh, Jesse, that needs to be the mantra for healthcare. How do you feel? How do you really feel?
I know. I think that we all have to do that. I recognize that, like, for me, even in talks, I put it in talks because I haven't asked myself in days, and even having it in the beginning of a talk makes me go, oh yeah, how am I feeling? Yeah. And it has become something I just even have in there to prompt myself, you know?
We don't really check in with how we feel, do we?
No, and it feels so silly, right? Like if someone says, like, you should ask yourself how you're doing. And my therapist asked me that and said, when's the last time you actually asked yourself and not other people? And I said, what a silly idea. Why would I do that, right? Like, why am I going to pause and ask myself how I'm doing? But really, no one else is going to, right? And also, nobody else really knows the difference between you yesterday and you today, or you a couple days ago and you today, and having more awareness of that is important, because most of us just measure how we're doing by, like, can we do work today? Has somebody said we're not up to date with work today or school, right? We measure it by these sort of, like, silly measurements that we think will show that we're, like, surviving. If someone doesn't mention we're not okay at work, then we must be fine. But most of us, at least I know for myself and a lot of my patients, can do work kind of like a robot. Like, we're really not good in the rest of our life, but we could still be like A plus in the workplace. And so it's not a good measurement.
Oh, you know, really what you're saying is so true, because that the measurement is output, and output and feelings are two completely different, disconnected things. I mean, I guess one could argue if you're feeling really, really good, your productivity is even going to be better, but that doesn't mean you can't perform.
For sure. And like, you could perform and be pretty bad off in the rest of your life with your social life or your family or the other things you have as obligations. You could perform. I'm an overworker when I'm stressed out. I sometimes think that if I just signed up for more or did more, I just won't have to deal with the rest of the things. And so, especially over the pandemic or places like that, where like, I just didn't want to sit with all that, I'd go, oh, let me do another talk. Oh, let me do another patient, because I thought that it would make me feel better. And like, in a way it does, because you don't have time to actually say like, nope, that doesn't feel good. You're just going and going and going. Yeah. But it's not like you're doing that at like the highest caliber possible.
Well, that's called autopilot.
Yeah, 100%.
You just hit that autopilot button and go. Let's get into your feels. How fun could that be? You know, get into Dr. Gold's fields. What inspired you to write the book, How Do You Feel? One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine.
You know, I see healthcare workers as one of my primary populations, and a lot of them wait a long time to be seen for exactly what we were talking about. Like, there's just this entire belief that, like, if work is fine, you're fine. But also, we have a pretty significant stigma towards our own mental health in our field. So we also have that kind of blocking us. And so by the time people come to see me, they tend to be quite sick. And then when they see me, they tend to say, this is the first time I've ever told anyone this, or I'm so alone in this. No one else feels that way. And I'm listening and listening and listening. And really, like, a lot of the stuff is similar, not only from what I'm currently experiencing as a psychiatrist seeing healthcare workers in the middle of a pandemic, but also what all of them are experiencing. And I'm like, I just feel like there has to be a better way where we could talk about their stories in an accessible way, where they'll feel less alone, where they'll understand that this isn't something that's just them or their problem, but it's something that all of healthcare is dealing with, but also all caregivers deal with. And so many of us just kind of shame ourselves for feeling that way. And I was hoping that in writing it, it would feel less shameful. It also helped me process a lot of my own experience in a way that I needed to. And that's how I picked up writing in the first place. So it kind of put all that together for me.
Let's give people a glimpse into the psychiatrist's world, because what you do is, it's quite invisible what you treat, right? So I think that people don't really understand sort of the blend of art and science and humanity and connection required to practice this specialty of medicine.
Yeah. So, you know, we go to med school, which is a difference for us. We go to med school and then we do 4 years or more of psychiatry specialized training. So if you see an OBGYN, they did about that for babies. We just did that for the brain. And so we learn how to look at somebody holistically, look at what they have going on medically, look at what their history is, and kind of decide what the best treatment is for them. We learn psychotherapy and are able to do psychotherapy, but a lot of us use medication as a primary thing that we do because we went to med school, we understand medicine, we understand biology. So it's a big part of, like, sort of our tools. But I'm a person who's not like a just meds person. You know, I think that there's so much going on in people's lives that you need to understand all of that to also figure out how to help them best. And not everyone needs a medicine. Some people need a medicine and therapy. And so we have the ability to kind of do both. So if you came to see a psychiatrist for a first appointment, it would be a lot of questions, a lot of questions about your current mental health and what brings you in, what your past history is, what your family history is, what other medical stuff you might have going on. And we kind of take that into account and kind of say, like, are there labs you should do as a result? Are there other things we should be looking at before we say this is what's 100% going on with you? Or is that really clear and we know what to do right away? And so we might then suggest medications and how to manage that moving forward. We might suggest medications plus therapy moving forward. Or there's obviously some other sort of alternative therapies that can happen if you've failed some over time too. So, you know, a lot of what we do is a bit of a art where we are the tool. So, like, we are the diagnostic tool. There's not necessarily, like, you know, an X-ray or a scan that can say you have X or Y. It's like
your DSM pops up on a screen somewhere.
Yeah, like, our job is to kind of be that, which is a different kind of art of medicine than I think it is for some people. I think people don't always have exposure to psychiatrists and might have seen us on TV in some way that was more negative. And I think most of the people I know really care about the person and chose to do this because they care about the person. You know, like, I loved that I could see 100 patients and maybe they all have the same diagnosis. Maybe they all have depression. Maybe at the end, I mostly give them the same sort of treatment. But why they came mattered and what was going on in their life that brought them there mattered. And it wasn't like just here's a scan, that's what's up, this is how you treat it. It's like, here's the person's life. This is what's going on. How can you take that into account while you think about treating them? And how do you support them as a human? And I think that was really important to me in picking a specialty. And most of my friends who do psychiatry, that was a big draw for them too.
I work with a lot of psychiatrists in my own practice. And the ones that are the best and the most valued and the hardest to get into are the ones that describe this art and science blend and their interest in the humanity
of their patients before the prescription pad.
Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people have had experiences where they saw a psychiatrist, they felt like they just asked them side effects or symptoms, gave them a med and called it a day. And it was really quick and it wasn't supportive. And that's not how I practice. That's not what drew me to the field. That's not the field that I'm excited about. And I get a lot of people who come and say they had that experience. And I hope that's not the predominant experience. And I hope it doesn't scare people from going to talk to a psychiatrist for fear of something like that. Because I agree. I think a lot of us do really care about this kind of balance of everything. Or we say biopsychosocial model. So how does your biology affect your psychology, affect your social, like your friends and your work and all of that. And how does that combine to think about how we treat you? And we know we work so closely with therapists and everything that we do if we're not the ones doing the therapy too. And I think it's a really multidisciplinary field in that way, pretty holistic in that way. And I think it really want, like, we really want to make you feel better and we really care about you, right? And I've seen it, you know, I see it work and I see it be frustrating and all of that. But I think, you know, being a person who cares about people, if it's frustrating, that's something you can work on together and you can understand like the challenges of all of this.
The question that you ask, how do you feel? I mean, I've been asked that question myself in the context of therapy and many years ago in psychiatry. And I found it to be such a huge emotional question for the recipient of the question. How do you feel? It's like, where do I start?
Yeah, I think it can go two ways. I think our automatic response is to say, okay and fine.
Yeah, I'm good.
Which, you know, which aren't feelings. And, no. You know, I make a joke in the book that like fine is feelings I'm not expressing, which is really what it is. It's a way to have the conversation without having the conversation. And so often we use that in like friendships or colleagues to just kind of say, look, I checked in and oh, you responded and we're good, but it's not true and deep and real. And, you know, in my office, like I want that to be a real answer. And I might not probe like the very first time I've met you, if you want to say, okay, I'm not going to be like, okay, it's not a feeling. What do you actually feel? Cause you might like shut down and never talk to me again, but it's definitely something that over time I will probe or over time I will challenge. Or, you know, I've had people just start crying, just simply like being in my office or being asked that question because they hadn't ever thought about it or didn't think they deserve the space to have that be asked of them in the context of everything else that's going on, and can often really surprise themselves by the fact that they cry or get emotional about something like that and, you know, apologize a lot as if like it's not a handshake in a mental health office to start crying. And so, you know, it's a lot of like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. I didn't expect this. I never cry, that sort of thing. But to me, it's like, well, of course, if you're going to cry, you're going to do that with me or a therapist or someone who actually sits there, gives you a safe space and asks you about you. Like that was pent up.
This is the beauty of mental health care. You know, this is why it's so important to encourage people who are having a hard time or not feeling their best to find somebody that they can trust to check in with. It doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. But it, like, we all need that. We all need a place to process how we're feeling, even like to just like open the door and say, are there feelings in there? You know, of course there are.
Yeah. And it's so different than a friendship, right? Like we need friendships. We need mentors. We need family. Yeah. We need people we can talk to about real things that are people we know because it's different. It's a different relationship. But, you know, having a person who's non-judgmental, whose job is to sort of walk you through your life and your history is just so different. And, you know, I have friends who are therapists and I still have a therapist, right? Because my friend's job is not to be my therapist, even if they're trained. Like that's right. Not their job.
Yeah, yeah.
They, you know, they might be good listeners because they're trained, but they, you know, their job for me is to not be my therapist. And so it's really helpful to have like a person who's just listening and just there for you and just trying to help you get to understand yourself better, which I think is something that all of us really want to do, but don't even know that that's possible a lot of the time.
It's like a good metaphor. We were talking about cars before we started our conversation, and I just actually gave this metaphor to a client the other day who was saying that they didn't need psychiatry. And I was like, well, let me ask you a question. You have a car, right? And they said, yes. I'm like, okay, if your car was broken, would you watch a YouTube video to try and learn how to fix it? Or what would you do? And they said, well, of course I would take it to a mechanic. I'm like, there's the answer. No.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's so obvious to people with other medical conditions too, that you would go to a doctor and get it treated. You know, if your blood pressure was high, if you had diabetes, if you had any of these other sort of chronic conditions, you wouldn't be like, this is fun. I'll just deal with this. And maybe it'll resolve. Like maybe it'll resolve on its own, but that's just like, that's magical thinking and it doesn't work like that. And I hope that there will be a time when it's very equivalent in people's minds and that they don't feel like the bar to get help for mental health has to be so severe that you need to do it all the time. I mean, even for me, like going to therapy is not always like I have X problem, I need to fix it. It's I need a place for that once a week. And if I have something acutely going on, great. If I don't, I'll talk about something and understand something from my past a little bit better. There's always something to talk about, but I don't necessarily, like I don't necessarily view it like Jesse is acutely struggling with this. I must go to therapy for this amount of time and get it fixed. And like, yes, some people do it that way, but I don't. And I don't think it should always be viewed that way because some of us just need those spaces.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we will continue the conversation with Dr. Jesse Gold. She is the author of How Do You Feel? One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine. To learn more, please visit drjessegold.com. You can find Jesse on most platforms at Dr. Jesse Gold, and that's J-E-S-S-I. Here comes the pause. We'll be right back. Harvesting Happiness is rooted in science. Our work facilitates applied positive psychology practices through media and consulting. We're committed to sound ideas for better well-being, leading to increased life satisfaction and a better world for everyone. We're not into pseudoscience or quick fixes. We're focused on common sense backed by rigorous research. Healthy critical thinking is the foundation for our discussions. We encourage you to challenge preconceptions and explore ideas with a curiously discerning mind. Collaboration with our guests is united by an inclusive vision to boost resilience, critical thinking, communication, and problem solving through civilized discourse and pleasurable relational engagement for everyone. Each day, we have the intellectual freedom to be happy or the liberty to be miserable, regardless of external circumstances. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, please seek support because good psychological health is vital to the achievement of a healthy and satisfying life. Visit harvestinghappiness.com for psychosocial and educational services that boost emotional and social intelligence. And we're back continuing the conversation with Dr. Jesse Gold about medicine of mind for caregivers, advocating mental health and wellness. Let's get back to it. Okay, Jesse, let's like dive into the stigma that still exists around mental health care, whether you're a doctor, you're a therapist, you're a nurse, caregiver, caretaker of aging parents. Like there's a stigma around this, needlessly and sadly.
Yeah, you know, I think some of it is just what culture you come from in the beginning, what it's like in your household, what it's like in your ethnicity group, what it's like in your religious organization, whatever it is. So you have this whole sort of baseline understanding of mental health that comes from your own cultures. Then there's a little bit that comes from television and movies, right? Like, how is it portrayed? How do we talk about mental health in the media, which is often related to violence, even though people with mental illness are more likely to be victims than perpetrators, but you see that very often. So that scares people. You see a lot of people with behaviors you don't understand being labeled words like crazy or mad or whatever it is. And they sometimes are criminals, but sometimes they're celebrities doing things people don't understand, like say Britney Spears shaving her head, whatever it is. Like that's what people see. And they say, well, I don't want to be quote unquote crazy and I don't want to be viewed in this way. And so that kind of seeps into you. So you've got your own culture plus television, movies, sort of popular press can like how they talk about mental health. Then you go to training, and training has its own kind of view of it. And, you know, medical culture is its own culture, sort of therapist training is its own training, and working in mental health is its own training. So in medical school, you learn very early that your feelings are secondary, if not tertiary, as far possible down as you can go from patients. So patients come first. Everything else doesn't matter. And you learn to ignore physical drives like eating and peeing, right? And so why would feelings count? You learn that to take time off work, you have to actively be hemorrhaging or hospitalized. So mental health doesn't tend to make that list either. So your conception of what counts as sick is very high. And your sort of ability to not be selfish or making it about you is very hard in the context of our job, because we're basically told that, like, if something sad happens, you can go to lunch right after and be totally fine. And nobody should have to talk to you about it because you're not a family member and this is your job and you just see and hear hard stuff. And so pretty early on, that's modeled in sort of like a hidden curriculum sort of way. And then sometimes explicitly in the way that people discuss other people. Sometimes mental health patients are stigmatized in the medical system too. So you hear that and you don't want that related to you. Like, I've had a patient who had bipolar disorder when she was in med school and told me that she heard people in the ER talking about a patient in the ER who was very similar to her, but she would never then tell her colleagues like, hey, that's also what I dealt with. You're just not viewing this right. And this is hurtful or anything. She was more likely to kind of like fold in and just tell me as a result, right? And then I think mental health training adds like a, you should take care of yourself because our job affects you. It should be part of your training that you go get therapy. However, also, like, it shouldn't be that sick because we shouldn't have that many problems. Like, there's almost like this, it's great if you do it as part of what you do for training, but I hope it's not because you actually need it kind of thing, which is what I hear a lot from therapists. I also think, you know, we're taught so much to be like sort of Freudian blank slates and somehow like not have ourselves in the room as if that's possible. And so we also are taught to depersonalize and sort of almost like dissociate from what's going on in the room to be able to empathize and be present and not absorb it, but also not put in our own stuff at the same point.
And that's not normal. Actually,
it doesn't make any sense.
What you just described is it's actually abnormal for the success of the therapeutic relationship, whether it's medical or psychiatric or psychological, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think most people want doctors or therapists that aren't themselves or aren't people having their own lives, but it's sort of what has traditionally been what's modeled and how the fields were founded. And, you know, there's been some evolution away from that, but it doesn't mean it's changed quickly because culture doesn't change quickly. And, you know, I think I didn't realize that I like dissociated in patient encounters and until like I had a time where my dog was really sick and she was he was in the like doggy vet where he was like in an ICU in an oxygen tank, and I wasn't sleeping, and I went to work and saw a patient, and the patient left my room and I started crying. And I was like, the world is really dark. And I kept just saying like, the world is dark. And I was like, what's wrong with me? Like, I've never had this happen before. And I realized that with not sleeping and being so sort of distraught in my personal life, I couldn't like put up that big defense for my job. And I actually heard what my patient was saying in a way that it went right into me, as opposed to sort of like Teflon reflected. Like, I don't think any patient would notice that I do this, because I think most people would say I'm pretty empathetic in the room, but there's like some level of disconnect that I do to protect myself, which I didn't even realize I was doing until, you know, I couldn't. And then I was like, man, the stuff we hear is so bad. And one of my best friends, like, what's like, we hear this all the time. Like, I'm confused. And I was like, something's wrong with me. But it wasn't like something was wrong with me. It was just like, I really listened because I had to, because I didn't have any way to defend against it. And I think it makes sense that our jobs affect us, and it makes sense that the things that we hear and see might have an emotional impact. But for some reason, like, we're taught that they shouldn't, and then we feel bad if they do. Like, we feel like somehow we're not doing our job right, or we're not representing the field accurately. Whatever it is, it sort of like becomes a, you screwed up, you fix that kind of thing, as opposed to like, well, duh, your job is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, well, which goes to the humanness or the humanity that is required in these caregiving fields and how little of it is taught in school, right? Like,
Yeah. I mean, most of us go into it because we want to help people. And that is organically the truth. Like, there are other things like, I mean, it is a good field with some prestige, with all of these like academic things around it. But most at the core are writing essays like, I just want to do this to help people, you know? And we do. But then we get there and there's competition for spots and there's people giving feedback that feels like it's about our personality. So we try to blend. Or there's medical, even like what you wear in medicine. You all wear the same, you're all wearing a white coat. Like it, you basically are not supposed to be this like highly individualized person. And so training sort of tells you like, well, you came in this way, but we'd like you to leave this way. And so to get there, you have to lose yourself in some way. It's not explicit, but it's true. And you're right. Nobody is like repeatedly checking on you. You're not like told to go to therapy to make sure somebody's checking on you. And you don't recognize the change in yourself because everyone else is kind of changing. Everyone around you is like that. And there's nobody saying like, hey, what happened to you, until you kind of have a moment of that yourself. And, you know, even in classes, like, you know, what's prioritized is that I learn all of the like infectious diseases, right? Like, but the class is like, hey, Jesse, go talk to somebody who's dying and learn what it's like to be dying and write about it. Like, I loved those like moments. I had friends who just like made up their stories because they were like, it's not on our board exam. It's not important. Wow. I'm going to spend my time going to learn about infectious diseases. And we didn't have a lot of those moments because, you know, they're fighting for space with a lot of information that we have to learn, that we're tested on. And it's hard enough to have them in there in the first place. And then they're so sort of like secondary to people where they're just like, why am I even doing that? I can make this story up without doing it. And it always made me go like, oh gosh. And in some respects, we do filter out a lot of people in all of the steps that probably do this for the right reasons because of competition and the kind of academic prowess you have to keep making it. And, you know, I did my master's thesis on pre-med as a culture because when I was in undergrad, I sort of looked around and I was like, all the people I like in my pre-med classes are not pre-med anymore. Like all the people that I thought would be so good at this and would be so like the person I'd want to send my family to, they don't make it through the stupid classes because there's too many hoops and they just don't work with their sort of like the humanity is not outweighing the sort of organic chemistry of it all. And that keeps going over time. And so you do like filter out people too. And so it's really interesting to see like where our values lie and what our priorities are in selection, but then also in sort of curation of a human during training.
And the need for training to adapt to this new world, especially when you think about its evolution to telemedicine, right? That you don't necessarily have the patient coming into your office where you can directly feel their energy or even touch their body, right? Medicine has become less touchy. So these communication skills are even more important, right? To forge that connection in a 15-minute visit. Like, how does that get done if you don't teach it?
It doesn't, you know, like, because you know, in so many ways we learn by seeing, right? And if right. The people who are showing us are not doing that, or, you know, in therapy or psychiatry training, they videotape us and then they give us feedback sort of like a football player with coaching. And if what they're giving you feedback on is that you didn't sit in silence like long enough and not like, hey, Jesse, like there is an element there that you could have like approached that person more as a person, then you're also not learning that because it's not what's taught or it's not what's prioritized. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a problem because, you know, the difference between me and AI or like a chatbot is that I'm actually a person. And I think in mental health fields, the thing that will keep us existing and not being taken over by AI like some other fields might is that people want a real person and want you to be human and want you to sit with them through their hardest times and the times they've never told anybody. And they don't want to talk to a robot. And I get it because I don't either. Like my favorite therapist is my current therapist and she self-discloses more than any therapist I've ever had. Not just like willy-nilly, like very skilled in the reasons she chooses to self-disclose and how, and it makes me feel more connected to her and understand her more. And I think it can be really powerful that way. We're not friends, right? Like she's not overly boundary breaking in some way where like I can call her all the time and just chit chat, but it's like in this way where I feel more connected to her as a person and therefore our relationship is stronger. And I see that modeled and I see how much I like that. And I say, well, I hope I'm like that for people too, because like the difference is immense in other people I've had as providers in the past where it's not like that. And I really do think that is the difference between us and like being taken over by a psych chat bot, you know?
Yeah. We're nearly out of time, mm-hmm. but I wanted to kind of wrap up the conversation about the need for us as humans to have a witness, right? Like, and to outsource support, like to core dump our garbage or our baggage on our closest relationships is not necessarily healthy for those relationships, but outsourcing it to the mental mechanic, right, is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, we need outlets. Otherwise, we bury it and bury it, and then numbness becomes the predominant thing, or outbursts of anger we don't understand become the predominant thing. Like burying it feels like a good idea because emotions feel scary and emotions seem like they're going to get in the way of success and work and life and all of it. But you can't actually like take a rock of emotion and bury it. It's much more like a beach ball, right? Like you push it down and it'll whack you in the face like more aggressively when you least expect it, right? And so, you know, I think we like to think we can do that and we can't. And so we do need these outlets. And if you're using your friends and family like that, it just is making it hard on them because they can only hold so much. They're not trained in it. They're then absorbing everything and your relationship changes in a way that you didn't expect it to or needed to, either because they put up boundaries because they can't deal with it, or they're overly trying to help you like you're now their patient, which isn't fair either. And so having someone else to make sure that we're not just like becoming numb to our emotions and hoping they go away, having someone else so we don't feel alone, because it's really easy to feel alone in what we're experiencing. It's really easy to blame ourselves. It's really easy to somehow say like, it's my fault that I'm reacting to this way. But really, there's so many reasons that's true. And it's probably not your fault. And there are ways to healthily kind of think about what you're experiencing within the context of your culture, your life, your experiences, all of that, which just tells a better story of how you're dealing with things. Like, I think the simplest stuff, even like, how do you react to an email? And does it make you mad? And why did it make you mad? And for me, I used to have that just be, oh, sometimes emails really frustrate me. And then I realized that, like, you know, emails are people asking for stuff. And if I don't have capacity, I get mad because I don't want to give anything else because I don't have anything else. It's not about the person. It's not about the email. It's about my capacity. Yeah. And understanding that really helped me understand my work day. And I think we minimize like how many times in our life, like really understanding our reactions, really understanding our narrative could just be overall healthier in sort of how we deal and how we cope and how we manage everything day to day, honestly.
And everybody needs a coach at some point in their life. And I think that's why focusing on mental health care is so important. It is part of our total health. It's part of what makes us have a happy life, you know, or a contented life. And that's why I love talking with you about this. Is I'm a champion, you know, like go get some mental health. You'll be so happy.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's super important. I think that the people who do the work need to remember their people too, and need to get help and get that done too. And like, that's part of why I love seeing the patient population that I tend to see, because I feel like I'm constantly like, Hey, you're a person too. And I think that that matters because it's so easy to lose that. But yeah, I mean, I hope that everybody feels like it's not a weakness to ask for help, that it's human to need help, that we all have feelings and they're not good or bad or something to be judged. They're just something that happens that teaches you something. And understanding that is what therapy's for, is what psychiatry's for, and it can really make a big difference in your life.
My guest today has been Dr. Jessie Gold. She is the author of How Do You Feel? One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine. You can connect with Jessie on her website at drjessiegold.com. On most platforms, she is at Dr. Jessie Gold. You can also find her over on LinkedIn at Jessie Gold, MD, MS. Come back anytime. Give a tune-up to anybody who listens.
Happy to. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on Harvesting Happiness. This is Lisa Cypress-Kamen on behalf of my guest, Dr. Jessie Gold, wishing you kind thoughts, kinder words, and the kindest of actions. Until next time, remember, happiness is an inside job. Happiness is your inside job. Please go out and rock your day, and remember to be kind to one another.
Want to explore more sound ideas for better well-being? Check out our new bonus edition content at More Mental Fitness by Harvesting Happiness on Substack and Medium. Subscribe, listen, and share hundreds of downloadable episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with and follow us on most social media channels. To learn more about lifestyle management and mental fitness consulting services, please visit harvestinghappiness.com. Harvesting Happiness and More Mental Fitness are produced by Lisa Cypress-Kamen, Andrea Mengele, Robin Boyd, Andrea Daly, and the excellent team at Podfly Productions, including Eric Begay, Kimberly Beck, and Alec Guess, in collaboration with TogiNet Radio, KBUU, RadioMalibu.net, and is available on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.